contract that we have is void. That's what the judge has said. So how are they going to sue us? Sue us for what?
A new plan for lawmaker space in Anchorage has lingering questions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for May 3rd. Tuesday, May 3rd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage School District chooses a new superintendent.
The board was particularly impressed with her energy, innovative ideas, and student-focused thinking.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The contentious plan over what to do with the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage changed again last night when the Legislative Council approved spending up to $12.5 million to buy the Wells Fargo Bank building in Anchorage's Spinard neighborhood. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the decision opens up even more uncertainties about the future of the LIO.
The council started looking at new real estate options after Governor Bill Walker threatened to veto a $32 million appropriation for lawmakers to buy the current LIO building in downtown Anchorage. In March, a state judge found the council had violated competitive bidding laws and negotiating renovation work and ruled that the state's 10-year lease of the LIO is invalid. Council Chairman Gary Stevens, a Republican senator from Kodiak, says amid a veto threat from the governor, he was forced to look for cheaper alternatives.
That really places me in a very tenuous, very difficult position because it's my job as Legislative Council Chair to make sure there's a home for the legislature in Anchorage, for the Anchorage legislators to make sure they have office space.
Stevens thinks the Wells Fargo building is the best deal on the table right now. The bank would rent out the first floor retail space for its branch. The vacant upper floors, Stevens says, are nearly move-in ready. Though he couldn't provide specifics for how much tenant improvements will cost, Stevens believes they'll be minimal and not add much on top of the purchase price. So the council is beginning a 60-day exploratory phase to make sure the building is structurally sound and can accommodate lawmakers' needs.
We want to make sure that if we decide to purchase it, that it's a building worth what we're paying for.
After talking with the governor's office, Stevens says he was assured that Walker would not veto this option, which a spokesperson for the governor's office confirmed. While the purchase price is much lower than buying the current LIO building, it's not clear how much more money the state might have to pay if a lawsuit is filed against them by the owners of the downtown property. Amy Slinker, a spokesperson for the building's owners, declined to say whether they're considering suing to recover millions of dollars sunk into the renovation and wrote in a text message only that they are reviewing the council's decision. Stevens says he is not concerned.
Lawsuits go both ways. You know, I mean, they could sue us, we could sue them. But, you know, the contract that we have is void. That's what the judge has said. So how are they going to sue us? Sue us for what?
Another uncertainty is how much of the $12.5 million approved by the council will go to a commission for the real estate broker facilitating the sale. Joe Everhart is the regional president for Wells Fargo in Alaska and says that on large commercial sales like this one, the company outsources the job of brokering a deal.
All I know is right now is that the legislature is interested. The legislature is talking to our broker. And that's all I know at this point.
Everhart estimates the commission will be at 4 to 6% of the sale price, which could mean as much as $750,000 for the deal's broker, Mark Dunn. For his part, Dunn says the commission is a moving target and declined to provide a specific figure, saying only that it would be less than 4% of the full sale price. The Anchorage Downtown Partnership asked the council to keep the office downtown, saying that moving the location conflicts with Anchorage's long-term municipal planning. The 14 members of the Legislative Council have to approve the purchase before a contract can be signed. With help from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
The Anchorage School Board has selected a new superintendent from two finalists for the state's largest school district. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
Dina Paramo is currently the superintendent of the Mat-Su Borough School District, but will take over the Anchorage School District on July 1st. School Board President Cameron Perez-Verdia says the board deliberated for about 2 hours on Thursday to make the final decision, using input from the community.
The board was particularly impressed with her energy, innovative ideas, and student-focused thinking.
Paramo has worked in education for 25 years. She says she knows Anchorage is very different from Mat-Su and will start her duties with ASD by listening.
Public education is part of the public process, and it really takes the community of students and staff and the community at large to really understand what do you want in your schools and what do you want for your young people. And I'll work to get us to those goals.
Anchorage Education Association President Andy Holloman says Paramo is capable and qualified for the job, and he's interested in getting to know her better.
Certainly, we've had a lot of feedback from different people, and there's some things that have been very positive. There's some things that some people have been upset about, and we'll see how policies go forward here.
Paramo was chosen over finalist Steve Atwater, interim dean of the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Education, and more than 80 other applicants in the nationwide search. She'll earn $235,000 per year. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Matanuska Susitna Borough School District officials say they will miss Dr. Paramo's enthusiasm and attention to students now that Anchorage has hired her. Susan Paugert, president of the Mat-Su School Board, says Paramo served as a teacher, principal, and assistant superintendent before she became Mat-Su superintendent in 2011.
We'll miss her greatly. She helped us become the best school district in Alaska. But I think Dr. Paramo is going to be successful in any endeavor she chooses.
Paramo started her tenure in Mat-Su in 1993. The borough school district has grown by about 400 students each year for the past decade. It grew by 708 students this school year. In 2011, borough voters passed a school bond package for six new or expanded school projects. Pauker says when Paramo was selected as one of two finalists for the Anchorage position, the Mat-Su School Board started looking ahead.
Well, we directed the staff to prepare a series of succession plans when Dina was selected as a finalist. We're prepared to make the best decision for Mat-Su. We're fortunate enough to have many dedicated employees and high-performing schools, so I'm confident we'll continue to offer the best education program for our students.
Dr. Paramo leaves the Mat-Su School District at a time when the borough's education operating budget is expected to be more than $249 million. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fun and efficiency of life on a boat.
This is my bed, my desk, my dining table. This is where William and I do school.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
The University of Alaska professor who was mauled by a bear near Haines a couple of weeks ago is now in fair condition at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. On April 18th, 35-year-old Forrest Wagner was attacked by a brown bear sow with at least one cub. He was leading nine students and two teaching assistants in a mountaineering course near Mount Emmerich. No one else was injured. Wagner was medevaced to Anchorage after a student used a satellite phone to call emergency services. The students were evacuated from the area by helicopter. Over the past couple of weeks, Wagner's condition has improved from critical to fair. He was moved from the intensive care unit to the orthopedic unit at Providence last week. An online funding page for Wagner's medical expenses has raised more than $24,000 in about a dozen days. The Juneau Assembly approved the guidelines for a city pot license on Monday. Those seeking to cultivate commercial marijuana will have to apply for the $250 license in addition to the state's. It's part of the Assembly's attempt to streamline the conditional use permit process and establish new guidelines for marijuana businesses. Commercial pot grows are zoned for industrial areas and some low-density neighborhoods like parts of Thane, North Douglas, and out the road of the community. Lisa Cohn, a North Douglas resident, testified that she wasn't happy about the possibility of living next to a grow operation.
We're at the point where we have to sort of put up with what's going on North Douglas, even though all the neighbors that we have spoken with are in disagreement with what's going on. But I feel strongly that individuals who are growing out there need to live on their properties.
The new guidelines say a person must live on site if they are cultivating commercial marijuana in a neighborhood that could be the owner or a tenant. Grow houses must be set back 25 feet from the property line. Two people testified that the shifting regulations could discourage new business. They said some of the regs were based on antiquated fears, but Assemblymember Kate Troll said that wasn't the case.
We want to proceed with this. I feel that we aren't driven by reefer madness and assuming that everybody is a bad hippie from those previous days.
The Assembly approved the city marijuana license and changes with a vote of 7-2. With warming ocean temperatures, the risk for paralytic shellfish poisoning can linger all year round. And Alaska has only one FDA-certified laboratory to test commercial shellfish. There are no labs to protect those digging for their dinner. But that may soon change. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska plans to open an environmental research laboratory this month to expand the testing market. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
This time last year, the room in the corner of the Research Protection Department was bare. And now it's got a fume hood, test tubes in every color, and this $49,000 machine.
This is the thing.
This is the big, exciting thing.
It goes beep.
That just looks like a big box.
Yeah.
It's your own R2-D2.
Yeah,
it's your own little robot.
Michael Jamros is the lab's new manager, and the robot in question is a plate reader, one of several machines that can analyze toxins in shellfish.
We shuck all the meat out, and then we put it in a blender to homogenize it.
Then Jamros extracts the toxins and removes the solids using a centrifuge. With a pipette, he'll dispense the solution in 96 tiny wells on one plastic plate. Imagine filling a tray with batter for 96 muffins. But instead of putting it in an oven, Jamros will feed it into a plate reader. He's running what's called an ELISA assay, measuring the toxicity of each well. The results appear on his laptop.
From here, we have our data that we can calculate from and figure out how much toxin is in our samples.
You hear that? Data. Cold, hard numbers that take the guesswork out of eating butter clams or blue mussels. In Southeast, there's never been a way for subsistence harvesters to assess the risk of paralytic shellfish poisoning or measure harmful algal blooms or HABs, which load shellfish with toxins. Until now.
You know, Native people have been harvesting clams for thousands of years, and, you know, and a lot of the elders I talk to, they don't do it anymore because they just don't know.
Chris Whitehead is STA's environmental program manager and the driving force behind the lab.
So to be able to bring that back and let them, you know, utilize that resource is huge.
When he came to Sitka in 2013, Whitehead wanted to create a warning system for clam diggers, just like in Washington State.
The Department of Health has a great website you can look at and see what beaches are open or closed to kind of monitor these events, these HAB events. And when I got to Alaska, there wasn't anything like that set up. So mainly I just wanted to go dig clams, and I didn't have anybody to call to find out if it was safe or not.
White called up Alaska's state lab, housed at the Department of Environmental Conservation. They test all commercial shellfish.
But the turnaround time for the data to actually be usable for us to prevent human health issues wasn't going to work.
And so Whitehead decided to create his own marine biotoxin program right here in Southeast. He secured over $1 million in grant funding over the next 3 years, and he formed a coalition of 13 other tribes in the region and organized trainings for them with state and federal agencies like NOAA to be eyes in the water, monitoring local beaches for toxic blooms.
So those sites will be monitored at the expense of the tribe and the resources that the tribes have. Every other week, so every tide cycle pretty much.
Jerry Borchert was in Sitka last fall to lead one of those trainings. He coordinates marine biotoxin management for the state of Washington and came up on Whitehead's invitation.
You know, I started, my first time here was a year ago in September, and it was a much smaller group. I think there were six tribes at the time. And a lot of these folks, you know, this is all brand new to them. You know, looking at plankton, trying to identify what a harmful species looks like, how to record it, and how to share this information. And it's those same tribes in the beginning that are now like the teachers, and it's expanding, and more tribes are getting involved. So, but this is amazing.
And that's not all. With the new laboratory, subsistence users can send their actual shellfish to Sitka and get results back in one business day. Eventually, the lab hopes to run tests for commercial entities like shellfish growers and processors. But some hurdles remain. The lab needs the blessing of an alphabet soup of agencies, most importantly the FDA, to become a full-fledged regulatory lab on par with the one in Anchorage. Here's Borchert.
Long-term stability is something I'm a little concerned with, and I hope that, you know, right now the state regulatory folks are finally coming to these workshops, and they're seeing what can happen.
So Whitehead is taking it one step at a time. The lab is running samples and sending their results to NOAA in Seattle for verification. If those check out, the lab will begin accepting subsistence shellfish as early as May. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska's capital is one of the most expensive places to live in the nation. With no roads in or out, Juneau has been dealing with what the city calls a stuck housing market. It's been suggested 1,000 affordable rental units are needed to keep up with the demand. For low-income people, this can be especially tough. But one Juneau family is taking matters into their own hands and challenging the convention of what makes a house a home. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Hey, do you know who a Carrie Joy is?
Carrie Joy doesn't have a home address, but she has really helpful neighbors.
Supposed to be a great boat.
Yachts, sailboats, and fishing vessels bob on the water at Aurora Harbor. And nearby, there's a row of small houseboats. What they lack in space, some make up for in character. They're fiberglass or made of wood, painted the colors of the rainbow. Carrie's is gray, which, at the moment, isn't really helping us out.
Hello?
But then she calls, and we're pointed in the right direction. Walking down the dock, we see it. The little gray boat with yellow trim. Carrie's 9-year-old son, William, invites us into a tiny door.
It's a construction zone.
This is my bed, my desk, my dining table. This is where William and I do school. This is where I write when I write.
This used to be a futon.
Carrie homeschools both kids, so it's also a floating classroom. And it's a space where William sleeps. His bed touches the foot of Carrie's. Her 14-year-old son sleeps in the back with little more separation, but there's no bedroom door. The entire home is just 200 square feet.
Privacy is a huge sacrifice. We have to be very intentional about giving each other privacy. I mean, you can look around and see that There's nowhere to hide here.
Without walls, personal boundaries replace physical ones. She says everything from getting dressed in the morning to taking a shower can be an obstacle, especially with her youngest, who loves to give running commentary.
Okay. Our life is a musical, and typically he sings it.
As a single mom, she decided to buy the houseboat 3 years ago.
When I came to look at it, I knew it would be hard. But it has a shower, has a flush toilet, and there was room to put bunks in. And I just loved it. It was just so sweet.
The cost, around $28,000. Carrie used to be a teacher. She was also a state employee. But now she makes money freelance writing and cleaning houses.
I make ends meet, first of all, because I don't have any debt. And then second of all, I keep my expenses extremely low.
That means making the most of about $1,600 a month. To put that in perspective, that's less than a third of Juneau's average yearly income. And Carrie's supporting two kids. She receives food stamps, and she's also eligible for federal cash assistance. But she hasn't taken it yet. That would mean having to first cash out a retirement with the state, something that up until recently, she wasn't ready to do. So at the end of the month, is this enough?
Well, I'm still breathing. And my children are still breathing. You know, they have shoes on their feet and their bellies aren't hungry. So I guess it depends on what you consider a need. Could we use some different things? Absolutely. You know, would it be nice to have a door that shuts that doesn't go to the outside? Yes, that would super rock. But is it necessary? Not at this point.
Carrie says what is necessary for her family is time. Teaching in the public school system left her feeling burned out. And as a parent, she didn't think one-size-fits-all learning was beneficial for her kids. That's why she decided to homeschool.
Honestly, it's for me, it was probably a pretty selfish decision because I like reading cool books. Hey, let's do this. You know, I like doing cool art projects. I like doing music. I like learning scientific principles. And I couldn't keep up in school. But teaching my own kids, we can discover those things together.
Carrie's family has lived on the water longer than she thought they would. The plan was to save up for a regular house. And she thinks that could still happen, but probably not until after her sons are grown. Right now, they're in the process of renovating the boat, and Carrie will eventually have her own room again. She says, from the outside, she might look poor.
But I am so time rich, and most of the folks who are struggling to make their ends meet are time poor and money poor. So no, had I not chosen to live on a boat here in Juneau, especially, again, considering lot rent with a trailer versus harbor fees for a boat, there's no way I could do it and be sane and happy and have sane and happy children. And anybody who knows me might wonder about the sane part, and I'm okay with that. But nobody will tell you that we're not happy. We are so happy.
And she's dating somebody she says can relate. He lives on a boat, too. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization wants to expand its service programs. Part of the effort could be funded by profits from a business it's about to purchase. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska lists more than 33,000 members. Speaking at a recent tribal assembly, President Richard Peterson said some do not get enough attention.
We divide ourselves and say, well, they live in Seattle, why should we serve them? Well, they're living in the village, you know, why do we care? We are Tlingit and Haida people. That's why we care.
The programs include financial assistance, child care, occupational training, vocational rehabilitation, and case management. But Peterson said most programs reach only part of Southeast Alaska. He and other Central Council officials want that to change.
We need to create our own income, our own revenue streams that allow us to do what we want with our funds and serve who we want with our funds wherever they live.
That income would be from a business purchased by the council. Richard Reinhardt of the Tlingit Haida Tribal Business Corporation said one was identified, but it didn't meet the corporation's goals.
The board wanted something that was more strategic, something that had more possibilities for growth in the future. And we were able to find one that is national in scale. They have a national presence, and that we believe we can grow double, triple the size in a very short, relatively short period of time.
He said that growth would come because a native-owned business gets preferential treatment when bidding for federal contracts. Many Alaska Native corporations use what's called the 8A program to raise revenue. Reinhardt wouldn't identify the business because of a non-disclosure agreement with the seller. He said an announcement could come this month. Central Council President Peterson said goals include improving services to veterans and turning its vocational training program into a tribal college. He also said it's time to expand Tlingit language programs to include Haida and Shamalgyuk, the Tsimshian language. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Researchers in Kodiak want to open up new markets and expand existing ones for a popular fish product. This delicacy is what you might imagine people at cocktail parties eating over stock market discussions. It's also good with tortilla chips. We're talking about roe, fish eggs, which in Alaska come from species like salmon, herring, and pollock. Roe produced in the United States is especially popular in East Asian markets, according to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. The Kodiak researchers say the majority of pollock roe goes to Japan and South Korea. They hope to market alternative forms of roe to those countries and China. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The two researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences have just secured funding and will now gather data and brainstorm ideas. Chris Sanito, a seafood technology specialist, says pollock roe can be a tricky food.
I would say it's kind of mild tasting in the raw state, but once it's cooked, it develops a little bit of a metallic flavor, so not very desirable.
Which is why it'll take experimentation to develop product forms that flatter pollock roe's flavor profile. And with roe value declining across all markets, it might be a good time for some innovation. A report from NOAA Fisheries says pollock roe value is at a historic low, yet it still brings in the high profit. According to the same report, the average price of pollock roe was a little more than $6 per kilo in 2014. That's compared to the second most expensive product, pollock fillets, which cost about half as much at $3.30 per kilo. Sanito and his research partner, Quentin Fong, write in their proposal that they want to cater to taste in East Asian countries. They plan to come up with possible products and do consumer studies. However, first comes a lot of brainstorming, a lot of research, and a lot of consultation. Sanito says nothing is off the table.
We're going to look at a lot of different ways to use pollock roe. And I mean, there's already in development, you know, people looking at salad dressings with pollock roe. In Japan, a very popular way to eat pollock roe is cracked or just opened up onto hot pasta, and it's kind of clings to the spaghetti noodles.
The project recently won almost $69,000 in funding from the Pollock Conservation Cooperative Research Center. Sanito says the first part of research will be looking at product concepts, which they'll start doing in the next few weeks. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for its Early Honors Program. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Early Honors students gain these benefits and make the best use of their senior year of high school. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco, and it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.